Welcome to another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. Today I'm delighted to be talking with Robert McDowell. McDowell is the author of many books, and his poems, stories, essays, and reviews have appeared in hundreds of anthologies and periodicals. He also worked as founding publisher and editor of Storyline Press, where he selected and edited 250 books, became a successful fundraiser, and created the Poetry Hour, a program for radio. Robert McDowell's new book is Poetry is Spiritual Practice. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you, Rochelle. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. It's great to have you. First, I want to tell you how much I just love this new book. It was like taking a class in poetry, poets, writing, and spirituality kind of all rolled into one.
Oh, that's great to hear. That's what I hope to. I hope people would feel that
way.
Oh,
good.
About this book, so.
Well, can you talk about what prompted you to write this book?
You know, it was really a reflection of, I think, in retrospect now, a reflection of my own spiritual journey, which was, long and winding and still going on, like everybody's is. I wrote the book five times over a period of about 5 years, and every time I would finish after a year, I would be very excited for about 3 days, and then as I would go through it, I realized it just wasn't it.
Wow.
So many times, I, as you can well imagine, there were many times I thought I was just going in the wrong direction and not figuring out what I really wanted to do with this book. When I finally realized that what I really wanted to do was not just to write a book about poetry forms or poetry exercises or a primer for poetry or even an advanced text for poetry, I wanted more and more to talk about poetry and present poetry as I was using it more and more in my spiritual practice. And that's really how the book took this form on. It really sort of grew almost independent of me and it came back to me as this is what needs to be done.
So you, in the beginning, it was a different book altogether.
In the beginning, you know, I'm saying this now in retrospect. I think I was much more sure of myself early on than I became, and that was a great thing because I just became very open to suggestion, the power of what the energy in the world wanted me to do. So, you know, writing this book coincided with my leaving my longtime job and really sequestering myself quite a bit, really sort of dropping out, if you will, from my normal life, or my normal life up to that time. And so the book became very, very important to me, but at the same time, I really more and more had no idea what I was doing.
Wow. Wow.
So, but it did come together at some point, and I realized, this is what I've wanted to do for some time. I wanted to... my spiritual practice became more and more important to me, deeper, and poetry was playing a huge part in that. And that surprised me at first, and at first I thought it was odd. But then as I began to read a lot and visit other teachers and meditate and think about this and write, I realized that, poetry actually is spiritual practice. It's at the heart of spiritual practice, regardless of what one spiritual practice may be.
Well, this is a good segue into my next question, because I wondered if you could talk about, maybe even give us a snapshot of what your daily spiritual practice looks like in connection to the poetry.
Well, I practice in the morning every day for about an hour, hour and a half. I am a Buddhist. Not that anyone's persuasion or a religious affiliation matters when I talk about this. So I was a Catholic most of my life, and I would be doing the same thing. But the practice of the Tibetan practice that I do is every morning is called the Nundro, which is the beginning.
Hmm.
A complicated practice, a series of prostrations, prayers, mantras, and meditation. And then I work into that sometimes at various points in the nundro, and sometimes after the completed nundro, and I continue on after a meditation by meditating on a particular theme, if you will, or concept. So I will meditate on compassion one day, forgiveness another day, anger another day. And I will recite poems, read poems that I have, that I know of, for those occasions or those feelings. And then I will also, often I will write a poem, or begin to write a poem, with the, you know, the theme of compassion, or the theme of play, or the theme of joy, or the theme of loss, and so on and so on.
Oh, that's neat.
So that's how I work it. You know, I've talked to many, many people who do it differently, and everybody's, the point is there's no right way.
Yeah.
There's just a way.
Yeah.
And poetry fits all ways.
Yeah.
Both always and all ways.
Well, I want to transition a little bit into talking about your writing practice. Because this program is primarily for people who are writers. And I've been thinking lately a lot about how I write, and I notice that I need a lot of space. I need people out of the house because I'm writing while I'm washing the dishes, I'm writing while I'm sweeping the floor, I'm writing while I'm doing the laundry, and not everybody in the world understands that you can be writing and doing other stuff at the same time. So I'm wondering about your daily writing practice, especially as a poet. What does that look like?
Well, you know, I'm probably very close to you, and I suspect many others who are writers or attempting to be writers or carve out time to be writers. It's very difficult. The writing act itself is very private, and it is an act that's ideally suited to solitude, to isolation. You know, it's interesting that then, once we've written something, of course, we're yearning to share it, in most cases, and that brings in the audience. But my writing, I try to allow myself to be more spontaneous. I used to adhere to a very strict schedule, where I would like get up at, 4 in the morning and write until 6, or get up at 6 and write until 8, you know, write 2 hours in the morning. And then sometimes write, often write then, you know, at night before going to bed. I do that less now, and I write more spontaneously.
Hmm.
So I always have notebooks around, and I carry a small one around with me when I'm just going around doing things. And I try to write down observations, write down lines that come to me or sentences that come to me, ideas that come to me, quotes that I like. I keep little 5x8 index cards that I write down quotes. I'm always writing down quotes from books that I'm reading, it's an integrated, that in itself is an integrated practice. The writing and the reading are sort of all tied up together.
Yeah.
So, I like to think that it's kind of like I'm writing all the time.
Yeah.
And you know, again, that's the benefit of having notebooks everywhere. I don't usually write cold into the laptop.
Mm.
Usually write longhand. So I might be a throwback in that way. I mean, I'm told more and more that that's like, you know, prehistoric stuff.
Well, you know, one of my favorite children's book authors, Kevin Henkes, I don't know if you are familiar with him.
That's a familiar name to me. Yeah.
He's done both picture books, and he's an illustrator as well and does young adult novels. But I just read an article about him that he writes all of his stuff. He does a lot longhand, but he also does no email at all. He's just totally offline as a way of attending to the discipline of writing.
Well, you know, the former poet laureate, wonderful poet, Donald Hall.
Yeah.
Same thing. He is not online. He is not, as he puts it, connected.
That's great.
And, you know, some people avoid avoid it, right. And it is a way, certainly, to, it's the great blessing of the Internet, but it's also the curse of the Internet that, yes, everyone has much more immediate access to everyone else.
Well, now I'm curious about kind of this bridge between writing in a notebook and then getting it into the computer and having all, notebooks all over the house and probably in your pocket as well. How does that kind of connect into kind of the more finished format?
Well, I mean, I'm always revisiting the notebooks, and I always have a sense, there's a feeling, something happens in me where I think, well, this is what I need to be concentrating on, focusing on. And, you know, I may go back to a notebook, I may go back and use something in a notebook that's 10 years old.
Wow.
Or 20 years old at this point, sorry to say. But, you know, yeah, I mean, it's the comforting thing to me is that there are things in the notebooks. And this is sort of a Donald Hall idea, actually, you know, to write something and just put it away and then go back and revisit it. I've had some great experiences and actually come up with some good poems going back through old notebooks and just kind of like saying, oh, gosh, this is really good. I don't remember doing this.
Wow.
This is when, how did I forget this?
Wow.
You know, and of course, it's a completely different take on whatever it was I was writing back whenever.
Wow.
But it's fun, you know. So at that point, when something like that happens, I usually go to the computer and start entering in because I really like to, you know, my handwriting's not the best, so I really like to see, you know, begin to see it on the page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm also curious because your book was packed with so much, you know, kind of technical poetry information, great stories from and quotes from poets, great poems. How did you manage all that information? Do you have some suggestions or tips for those of us who are trying to do similar things?
Well, you know, it's hard for me because I'm probably more an intuitive than an analytical.
Yeah.
So, you know, the analytical person I always envy in projects like that because, you know, they can do research so well.
Yeah.
I was always sort of ashamed of my, you know, sort of inferior research skills all through school, for example. you know, I do my best. What I did with all the material, and you're right, there are all kinds of diverse things I pulled together. Again, those 5x8 note cards are very important. So I reading, vast and wide reading, is very important.
Yeah.
I like to read all kinds of things, and I usually have about 20 to 30 books going at the same time.
And you put your quotes on those note cards.
Well, I do that. I do that for my hardbacks. Now, if it's a paperback book, I will. I love to highlight, yellow highlight.
Yeah.
So I'll do that if it's a paperback and it's not signed by the author. But if it's a hardback or if it's a signed book, you know, then I don't feel comfortable like marking it up. I can't bring myself to do that. But you know, I do have these note cards and I write down a lot of just a lot of quotes and. You know, I'll put the page number and the book title so I know I can go to the book and look it up and see it in, you know, larger context.
And then how do you organize all the cards? Do they just end up all over the house or do you have a
I keep them all stacked up and I go through them sort of like they sort of remind me of the way I go through them all the time is like the way I used to go through my baseball card collection.
Oh, neat.
When I was 12 or 8 or whatever,
you know. Oh, that's great.
You know, you carried them around with a rubber band around them in your pocket, you know. And took them out at school when you were supposed to be reading, you know, European history or something.
Well, it sounds like this would be a great spiritual practice in and of itself, just flipping through these quotes.
Absolutely right, you know. It reminds me of, like, what Daniel Odier, the French Buddhist teacher, told a student who was, sort of saying, you know, I don't get it with my practice. I don't get any of this. And he said, well, what do you like to do in the morning when you first get up? And he says, I love to have a cigarette. I mean, I know I shouldn't smoke, but I only have a couple a day, but I really love that one. And he said, you really love that first one, and you look forward to it. Yes, I mean, it's in many ways the happiest thing in my life. And he said, that's your practice.
Wow.
Smoking that cigarette. You're doing a great job.
Well, you know, Carolyn Mace has the same kind of thing. She talks about her rituals and she talks about whatever you do in the morning is the way you gather your power and do your spiritual practice. You don't maybe see it that way.
I think that's right. You're right. And you mentioned a great teacher there and someone that, you know, certainly is an inspiration.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was just so overcome by how many amazing writing exercises you had in the book. I wonder if you could share a simple exercise with our listeners that they might be able to try?
Well, one is one that I really like, and this is totally random because I just picked this up. I'm actually opened up to the chapter on the Pantoum.
Yeah.
And it's newspaper headlines.
Ah.
They're excellent sources for Pantoums. For example, here's a quatrain created from headlines on the paper, of the paper that was on my desk at the time I wrote this. And it goes like this: illegals should come out from the shadows. Paragliders take a leap from wood-wrapped mountain. A race of survival, go with the flow. Find a good book for summer reading.
So you're basically arranging newspaper headlines.
Exactly, right.
And, to make a poem.
Right, and you play with it. You just play with it. They may or may not serve you in your next stanza or in the stanzas after that, but, you can use them and see what happens. Let's see, another one might be the parrot pantoums. This was fun. One of the things I try to keep saying in this book over and over is that poetry is fun.
Yeah.
And, you're trying to get past that misconception that so many people have, that it's like, oh, that's really hard and I don't understand it. And, you have to, go to college and get a bunch of degrees before you could ever hope to, read poetry, let alone write it.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, no, it's not true, So the parrot pantoum exercise is, if you do not actually know a parrot that speaks in pantoums, imagine teaching one to do so. Come up with phrases and lines you think would sound memorable coming out of the beak. Now think about that. Share
That's
them
great.
With your friends and perhaps with patrons at your local pet store. There may even be a side career in this, teaching parrots poetry.
Oh, that's great.
Perhaps this is not as silly as it sounds. The sleeping potential audience for poetry is everywhere, and it really is. So, that's an example where, and you think about, the obvious thing we always think of with a parrot is Polly Want a Cracker.
Yeah.
And we can hear things like that. But, there are all kinds of things you can do.
Wow.
Another exercise that, obviously is, this is one that we all do, writing to the end words. So a secret to feeling really comfortable writing in traditional forms, meaning poems like sonnets or villanelles or sestinas, is to set up an exercise where you take care of the rhyme scheme for someone by just writing down the right-hand side of the margin, write down your end words. And you have the rhyme scheme with the end words you choose. And then you just have someone write to the end words, and you tell them not, you don't even worry about making sense or connection or any of that. Just let it go. And just write to the end words. Now, I'll give you a great example of this. I was asked by a counselor I know to sit in for him so he could go to his daughter's graduation, to sit in on a Saturday 4-hour workshop with 20 paroled addicts who were not at the moment using. And it was a part of their paroles that they had to attend this workshop. So I agreed to do this, and there were a number of things that he had planned that we had to do, but he said, I'll leave you an hour to do whatever you want.
Wow.
And, that was a little, I wasn't quite sure how this was going to go, but, we got to that point in the afternoon, and we had, we'd established a kind of rapport. They're very suspicious at first when someone new comes in.
Yeah.
But we had gotten over that, and we were having some good discussions and dialogue and rapport had developed. So I finally said, listen, let's. How do you feel about doing a writing exercise? They all looked very, they looked around the room and hemmed and hawed, but finally they did it. They said, sure, okay. So I gave them this exercise. I gave them the end words, and they wrote to them, and they wrote some extraordinary, revealing, tender, frightening, dynamic things.
Wow.
And we went around the room, and they read them, and we talked for a moment about each one. And, a couple of them cried, and there was, again, it really pulled everybody together in a way that, may have been unusual for that group. And when we were finished, when it was all done and everybody had spoken, And it was about time to leave. I said, listen, I want to congratulate you guys because each of you has just written your first Shakespearean sonnet.
Mm-hmm.
And they had.
Wow.
You know, they didn't know that. It was complete news to them. They were shocked. But you know, you could see, too, that it tickled them. So
those are great exercises.
So they work, yeah. Yeah, and you know that because you're always on your site. You're always offering some great exercises.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I work with teens in the city, and same way. They give them an exercise, and they come up with amazing material.
Right, right.
I wondered if you could put on your editor hat for a minute, because you've got this great history as a book editor, and I wondered if you could tell our listeners what would make a submission stand out to you, and from both sides, from the side of, oh my goodness, never in a million years, to, oh yes, absolutely.
Boy, it depends. You know, it would depend on whether we were looking at a submission for a magazine, for example, or book publication.
Yeah, well, let's say book.
For book, okay. What always appealed to me, and it might surprise you, that, you know, I didn't necessarily care that much about, you know, where you'd all been published.
Huh.
That isn't what I looked at first. I would just begin to read. And if I felt the book had a coherence to it, If I could sense an energy and a presence that seemed consistent, say in the first 5 to 10 poems,
yeah,
then I guess that's what you would call the equivalent of being hooked.
Yeah,
and I would keep reading.
Wow.
And you know, I mean, it's I'll give you a great example. One of the most unlikely finds for me was to discover a poet who lives in Coos Bay, Oregon. Her name is Ginger Andrews.
Hmm.
Ginger really had a limited education, didn't go much beyond high school, didn't go beyond high school, I don't believe. Got married early, worked as a cleaning woman, and taught Sunday school. But she always read poetry. She loved Emily Dickinson. She taught herself poetry. She wrote poetry all the time, and she wrote these gritty poems about her life.
Wow.
So there are a lot of cleaning lady poems.
Well, I remember the one from the book.
Yeah.
That was one of my favorites. I used to work as a cleaning lady, and I thought, man, this is so good.
There you go. And she wrote, she just had this disarming honesty and simplicity and just clarity and about her. It was very refreshing.
Wow.
And so there's an example. You know, it's just, I guess the biggest thing I would say is be yourself. Write about what you know. That's a huge thing. Write about what you know. I mean, if you're like me, you want to know everything about everything.
Yeah.
And that's great to live that way. However, you know, when you're writing, you really find that you need to write, you really need to know what it is you're writing about. And that can be the, you know, the your rounds as a cleaning lady, or it can be you know, your life as a Major League Baseball player, or it can be you're working in a bank, whatever it is.
Wow.
So I would say that, write from what you know, be as honest and clear and direct as you can be.
So if you, from a magazine editor's perspective, what's the different take there?
Well, a magazine is a little different. The first thing I think you have to do is convince the editor, subconsciously at least, that you've really looked at the magazine.
Yeah.
You are you don't have to be the world's biggest fan of the magazine, but you should know the kind of poems the magazine publishes.
Mm.
So, for example, if you're submitting poems to a magazine that publishes mostly language poetry, and you are a new formalist writer, that's probably not going to work. They're not going to look at you. If you are, you know, if you're publishing, if you're trying to publish long poems that tell stories in a magazine that never publishes a poem like that, then it's probably pretty much a waste of time.
Wow.
The other thing I would try to, you know, see if you can match up your poetry, you know, with some of your poems with the kind of with the magazine that you're thinking of sending to. That requires a little research and a little contemplation.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I would just say don't be discouraged. I mean, the greatest enemy, I think, of a poet who is trying to get published, of course, is being discouraged.
Oh, yeah.
You know how that is. I mean, I had a great mentor once, George Hitchcock, who's now 94 years old, but, the founder and editor of Kayak Books and Kayak Magazine.
Yeah.
And he, and a great poet himself, but I remember him saying back in college days, for me, he said this to everybody, you send poems out like you do the laundry. You know? I mean, you just have a batch and you send them out and when they get rejected, collect the rejection slips and put them on your wall. And
so I would say I send poems out like I send out the garbage every day. Maybe not the laundry.
Well, exactly. Right. It's the same thing. the rejection slips are, going to be like 1,000 to 1.
Right. Absolutely.
I mean, maybe that's exaggerating, but I don't know. I mean, I would say that, come on. I mean, I've published probably a few hundred poems in my life in magazines, and
wow.
I'm sure that I have, several thousand rejection slips.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's harder now. I really do. I think, it's easier to get your poem published anywhere for free. It's
right.
Harder to get published in the periodicals.
Well, I think you're right. And, it's a paradox, isn't it? I mean, I think that, and I know a lot of these editors, they are absolutely swamped with submissions.
Yep.
They have very few spaces, really. I mean, think about, again, how many poems are in each magazine
yep.
issue as compared to how many submissions they're getting. So it's tough. On the other hand, it's never been easier to share our work because, again, we do have the Internet. And we have a lot of, blogs, websites, self-publishing options that we never had, even just 20 years ago.
Right.
And I think that's a great thing. That's a great thing.
Well, yeah, and I think the people who want to go publishing the traditional route do that, and the people who want their just stuff just out there can do that too.
Absolutely. And more, these online magazines, are now counting, in traditional circles.
They're, oh, they are.
They are now counting the same as a print publication. So, for example, if you were doing a book with Norton,
yeah.
A book of poetry with Norton, you would be counting your online, your internet publication credits right alongside, a poem that might have appeared in Poetry Magazine or the Hudson Review or, wherever.
Oh, that's just amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's a big deal now. In fact, they're very serious about it because it's they're concerned about copyright infringement and all of that. You have to go ask permission of the internet magazine that you published in or the blog you might have published in.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that, and I want to thank you for taking time to be with us. I wonder if you have a final tip to leave with our listeners.
Well, the final tip would be, I think, there's so many.
I know.
There's so many. Follow your heart. And,
yeah.
Believe. See the ways, find the ways, be sensitive to the ways that poetry is integrated into your everyday life, into your spiritual practice. It's not something that's set apart that you do that's really remote and removed from the most deep, the deepest and most important part of you.
Hmm.
And I think that's what I would say. I would wish that for everyone.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. It's been just wonderful to have you with us.
Oh, thank you, Rochelle. It's an honor, privilege to speak with you and people listening and anytime.
Great. Thanks.
Okay.
This has been another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. You can find a link to Robert McDowell's website and his new book at my website, rightnowcoach.com. Thanks for tuning in, and remember to always write.